Welcome to Hot Boga. This podcast is sponsored by ASAC Camo, the camo you wear hunting, not on a date. All right, next one up. Our next sponsor is New Breed Archery. Check out their custom options at newbreedarchery.com and have your next bow shipped direct to your door.
All right. Next one is Black Eagle Arrows. I miss the target a lot, and I have yet to break a Black Eagle Arrow. I don't know why. I don't know what kind of voodoo magic they use to make these things so strong, but I love it. Check them out. All right, next up is Seek Outside. They make incredibly strong, light gear. So if you want a light pack that can haul a lot of weight, if you want to be warm in a teepee out in the middle of the woods, check them out. They make amazing gear. Seek Outside.
FHF Gear has really found a way to pair functionality of the hunting and fishing industry. They're proudly made in America and backed by a warranty that exhibits not only their confidence, but also their belief in customer service. So FHF Gear, fish, hunt, fight.
Finally, our last sponsor is Burris. They make some fantastic, innovative, durable, and accurate products, especially the new Oracle Bow Sight. It's going to change the way you hunt. Check them out. No, and maybe that's not a bad thing. No, not a TV.
If we have to hear Elsa in the background, I might be okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect.
Well, hey, thanks for taking the time to come on. We really appreciate you, you know, taking time out of your day, especially it sounds like your family time, Ross. Happy to have you here.
No problem. Thank you, guys. It's not typically it's much easier than this. I had a dog who had some sort of eye surgery today. It's almost like plastic surgery, which is kind of odd.
Really?
She had like a eyelid problem, so they sewed up her eyelids, and I was telling Bridget, normally she looks like she's like a little bit not the smartest dog in the world, and I think the surgery actually made her look like a little smarter.
Nice. You know, you got it. You know, take whatever.
You squeeze a little bit there, pull a little here.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, the vet even said, he's like, man, she looks like she's actually kind of with it now. So that's good. That's good.
That's
she's got the cone of shame on.
I was, you know, it's interesting because just kind of getting ready for this podcast, I was reading a little bit about you. I actually read an article that you wrote about your dogs, which is really like a really an emotional article about one of your dogs dying and the new dog that you got. So.
Oh yeah. And unfortunately, God, I forgot I wrote that a long time ago. That dog that, it gets sadder. That next dog passed away as well. But, now I've got two of his sisters. So,
okay.
Well, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you did your research. I hope I'm not too disappointing.
Well, when I was doing my research, I thought, man, you sound like a dog guy, and it's good because, so I'm James and Jared's here with me.
Yep.
In college, he and I decided to get a dog, which I think a lot of college students do, and then they really regret it very quickly afterwards. So
it was more of an impulse purchase.
Yeah. So our dog, I mean, he got into beer and all sorts of things and, you know, kind of lived the college life with us. But now, you know, this is almost 10 years ago, and he's still around. And I'm wondering if you have any tricks for teaching an obstinate beagle how to like obey or change, turn his life around after, you know, turning 11.
I don't know if I can help you with that. I don't know much about beagles, but I know that they're not easily trained. And I'm sure at 11 years old, if they're anything like my older dog was, they don't care.
No, he doesn't care. He smells something, he'd take off. Actually, we're just cleaning up. On the way in, we record. I've got a recording studio at my house. One of the guys stepped in his poop and tracked it in the recording studio. So prior to this, we've been doing some cleaning. Yeah.
The air fresheners are going quite strong right now.
Yeah. So
I might have to send you guys a picture. Sam's a dog with surgery, and she has the cone of shame on, which she managed to break in literally like 10 seconds. And now... Now she won't move. She has not moved in 10 minutes. She's 10 months old, so she's almost always moving, and she won't move right now. She's terrified of her cone.
That's so fun. That's the worst, though. I wouldn't want a cone in my head either.
No, exactly. Yeah. So I think, generally speaking, Bridget and I are talking about it. I'm not sure what kind of topics you guys want to cover, but Bridget had a much more interesting hunting season than I did. She had like a hunt of a lifetime or two of them. So I'm more than happy to do the brunt of the talking on sort of business stuff, product stuff. I know you guys wanted to talk about that.
Sure.
And then as we kind of roll into more, maybe talking about our seasons and this, I mean, Bridget's got a hell of a story. She gave it hell this year. So I think that'll be much more interesting.
Hey,
than.
Frost is probably being a little humble. He's more of a bird hunter, so he's got plenty of stories. He just didn't have a chance to get as much big game hunting in.
Oh, sure. So I've been recording because, yeah, I was telling Bridget that I did an hour and a half podcast a little while ago and totally forgot to hit record. Mm. So
it was a dark
day. I've been recording since we started just because now I'm scared of messing it up. Before maybe we move on, could you guys introduce who you are and what you do at First Light?
Sure. Yeah. So my name's Ross Copperman. I am, responsible for sales and marketing at First Light. I've been there going on 6 years.
I'm Bridget Noonan, and Ross hired me 2.5 years ago to come on to handle the marketing side of his world. And at the time, I came on when we actually had a completely different business model and a lot of different distribution channels. And since then, we've gone direct to consumer. So in the past year, I'd say I've really narrowed my focus to all things marketing, content, digital, all of the above, as well as the conservation side of things.
So you're direct, now you're direct to consumer.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. And actually, the first that I've heard much about either of you was in the tag video series. You have like a hilarious chat text string, you know, that you show at the beginning of the video. That's
that
like
makes me look so bad. I swear, I don't swear that.
You have a potty mouth, and you know that's what it is. But no, it's so funny because at the end, it's like my life blows or something like that. It's cracking me up.
Yeah, that was me. I was home on the couch. I had a super duper inner ear infection at vertigo and all sorts of stuff. So I couldn't go to that show, and Bridget's texting me all this, and I'm like sitting there, I can't even stand up without like falling over. And meanwhile, people are winning sheep tags, and I totally got her language. I get it.
It was just crazy that out of all those people, two of your people won something, it looked like, which is incredible.
I know. I think some people were looking at us like, what did you do to deserve this?
This is sponsored by First Light. Yeah.
I know. That show is coming up here in about a month, and we were just talking about, I don't know how we're going to be able to top last year.
That was incredible. It was an incredible story. I mean, and the guy's name is Tag, which is like pretty ironic too.
Yeah. His first ever, not his first ever hunt, his first ever big game hunt. He had been on one bird hunt, I think thanks to Ross, if I remember correctly, and had shot one mallard and one quail.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
that's hilarious.
I think that's accurate. And I think that was literally, I mean, that doll sheep hunt was his second hunt ever, period, which is
he's
pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah,
he did a heck of a job, mm-hmm. And you taught him. Well, I mean, I watched through a couple times, and even just to prepare to talk to you guys, and all the practice that you brought him through, Ross. I mean, that's some patience right there.
It was actually, I mean, and I'm not BSing anybody. It was the easiest thing I've ever done. Tag is, first of all, his attitude is ridiculously positive all the time. He's also a spectacular Division I athlete who's extraordinarily disciplined. And the most important thing, I think, is simply that he'd never shot a rifle before. And we all know that's like way easier to tease someone who's never done something before than try and correct bad habits, right? So it was really easy, and Tag took everything ultra seriously. He was over at my house so often shooting, you know, not even the episodes on the camera, though, just showing up that my mom and my wife, you know, were rooting him on. My mom still would email me like months later, like, how's Tag doing? Like, he's part of our family or something. So, he really gave it everything he had.
That's so cool. What was the hardest part for preparing him for that? Was it just rifle, teaching him how to use a rifle, physical stuff? I would imagine he's in pretty good shape.
Yeah, the physical part was honestly like a 100% non-issue, and that's definitely not my department anyway. I think, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think the shooting part, the toughest thing was it's a lot to wrap your head around in a very short amount of time when you have to apply that lesson to an extraordinarily high stakes moment and like stress moment, right? I mean, he's got, at best, he'd have one opportunity and he's got to remember everything that we kind of condensed.
Yeah.
The basics was easy enough, how to pull a trigger, all that sort of stuff. And then we found ourselves with a little less time, you know, getting into using how to use his optics properly. And I think it was like a week before he left, I finally got him into like sort of automatically cycling that second round and keeping his eye on the target and things like that. So hoping that he was going to put all this stuff together at the last moment, I think, was probably the most stressful thing, but nothing really stands out as the most difficult moment, I guess.
Yeah, it went well. It was Great.
Yeah.
Great series. So, Bridget, it sounds like you had a pretty epic hunt. You want to walk us through what your year was like this year?
Yeah, I had an incredible year, but I guess I should preface it with the fact that it's really only my second big game season in Idaho, because I used to live in Western Pennsylvania and have a little bit more of a whitetail background than anything.
Oh, sure.
And so I kind of jokingly, like, you know, on year one, I came to Idaho and I put in for a moose tag because Cal here in our office had given me a little bit of moose from one of his BC hunts. And it was so good that I was like, yeah, I need some of that in my freezer. I think the odds of actually drawing this tag were like 3% that year.
Yeah.
I knew I wasn't going to get it. But, you know, I jokingly put in for it my second year. Ross actually put in for it too. So he's a little bit salty. Probably stewing over there.
He stole my tag.
I drew it.
You have a video about your reaction though, don't you? I think you had a little bit of a potty mouth on that too.
Okay,
yeah, that's possible.
That's right.
I think we might have had to bleep something. Okay, so I guess I swear a little bit. But yeah, it was that crazy and just unbelievable that I managed to draw that tag. And it's a lifetime hunt. So the big three here in Idaho, moose, sheep and goat, are once in a lifetime. Once you draw that tag and harvest, you're done.
Right.
And so I, believe it or not, drew that. And then I think a couple of days later, I found out on our second drawing that I also drew a late season cow tag, which isn't like as glamorous or sexy of a tag, but it's, you know, more of a sure thing, kind of like amazing in your freezer. So I went into the season pretty psyched about that. But it's not really a quick story, because I thought it was going to be a little bit more of a sure thing, just from what people, I spoke to a lot of moose hunters and they were telling me, you know, they don't move that far. They don't move that fast. Yeah. They're huge, you know, like 1200 pound animals. It should be fairly easy to find where they are and pattern them and watch them and, you know, figure out which one you want to shoot. And I certainly found a lot of moose, but never was it easy. I mean, I hunted almost every day of the 90-day season. Literally so hard that I just found out I have Achilles tendonitis.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I wouldn't trade that, because I definitely learned this valley better than I ever would have. And I know it's so much better now in and out. But it came down to literally the last week of the season, which is really freaking stressful. And I managed to shoot my cow the week prior. So I had a full, like, month of just processing meat.
That's a lot of meat.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was nonstop. It got pretty freaking old, just like cutting steaks up. But
so you butcher it yourself?
Yeah, I wanted to. I certainly didn't know how to prior to the season, so I had some friends help me. But I wanted to make sure I knew what was what and how to do this right. So it took a minute.
You said that was your first time?
Yeah, my first time butchering. That's anything, really.
That's a big task to take on first round.
I feel like it's more physical, but, you know, actually, I sometimes have a harder time with, like, butchering small stuff, just because I rip stuff accidentally when you're like a bunny.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I have a hard time with those.
There's a little bit more room for error just because there's just so much of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it is, like, it's monotonous. It's just, you know, getting down to the little silver skin and trying to trim everything perfectly and knowing I'm going to tear a lot of this meat and you want it to be, you know, good right out of the package. So it took many, many days.
How much meat do you think you got out of that, out of both of them?
Between the two, I'd say I have over 500 pounds of meat between two and a half freezers right now.
So are you giving it away to people at First Light? Are you friends and family? Are those all your
friends? Yeah, Bridget, are you giving it away?
You got some coming your way. And this wasn't like, this absolutely was not something I could accomplish on my own. I had so many people hunting with me. I hunted with every person in our First Light office. I met so many new people through this and people who had the tag in previous years. So I'll definitely spread the love around.
Yeah. And it's delicious meat. Moose is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've definitely had a chance to experiment. I love cooking and I've gotten into a lot of different things. I never would have thought I'd be cooking with it. And I got a lot of things bone in that's been fun to try.
Yeah.
And actually, if I ever get around to planning it, I'm going to be getting married in the next year or so. So I'm hoping to actually serve moose meat either at the wedding or the night before or something.
That's amazing. Yeah, you work for a camo company. I feel like it would only be appropriate to serve some, you know, wild game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and there's so many more cookbooks, I feel like, now for cooking things in better ways. You know, Steve Rinella, who's a Michigan guy and I know works with you guys. he's put out tons of great recipes online. And then you have, you know, bunches of other guys that just, yeah. It's way more fun to cook stuff like that now.
Oh, the Meat Eater guys, all of them, their whole team, they've all been inspiration. They've got this new gal I haven't met, but she does all cooking, wild game cooking. She has a lot of bird stuff, but she's got some big game recipes I've been pulling from. And then obviously Ranella, and we have our friend Eduardo Garcia. He's amazing. Yeah. He has four recipes. So I've been definitely stealing some of his stuff too.
Yeah, it's funny because growing up we would have, so we hunt and shoot and eat a lot of venison. And it was like, you get maybe a roast, mostly burger. And then, you know, my family's thing was to can it. And so there's like three different things you have, and there's no like variety. Sometimes maybe you get a chili. And now it's like, you know, oh, I'll do a slow roasted shank.
More finer dining with some of these
that's right,
game meat, which is cool.
It's definitely a newer thing. There's a couple, like, call them the older, more, I don't know, worn hunters in the valley that have gotten really excited when I pulled this moose tag. And they are, I feel like I've been teaching them a little bit more to get a little bit more adventurous with the cooking side of it. Some of these are guys that have helped me learn how to butcher. Mm-hmm. And they were like very quick to want to just grind things up or leave things, like, you know, maybe not use everything. And I really wanted to try different things. And if you don't, you know, keep the extra bones or keep some things going on, you maybe won't be able to get as adventurous.
So what's the most adventurous dish you've made out of your kills from this year?
I went to a dinner party recently and I brought some elk tartare.
Ooh.
Which was amazing, but that's definitely for like the risk takers because they had to trust that, you know, I took care of this well enough to eat it raw.
Yeah, for some people listening who maybe doesn't know what tartare is, you want to explain what that is a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly raw elk meat. I used the eye of round for this and, you know, just diced it up basically into bite-sized pieces and you mix some fresh herbs in with it, but it's truly that simple to make and it's just all about keeping it cold and making sure you take care of the meat from the field all the way to the table. And, you know, I just served it with some crackers, I think, and it turned out great.
So good. Yeah. I think I can top you, for most adventurous meat cooking.
Yeah, okay. That's one area I will never go.
So there's two things actually. And it was both inspired by, you know, the Steve Ranella, cookbook and actually maybe a show. I don't, the fat of the behind the eye. He had once done on a caribou, and I tried it on a deer, and I don't know, it wasn't good. It wasn't bad, but it was just.
Did it taste like dough?
It didn't taste, well, maybe, I don't know. I was just digging in there, grabbed a piece of what looked like fat, and it was just chewy and white. I don't know. So.
No taste.
Nah, it wasn't, no, maybe that's it has to be a caribou to taste better. It was a Michigan white-tailed deer. Okay. So that was one. The other one that is really risque was the testicles that I fried up.
Nice.
And no one would try them. I was the only one.
Not doing it.
And they were pretty good. They were bacony. They were.
Did you fry it?
Yeah, I fried it up just in oil. And I think I fried them too long because like both of them kind of popped. But but they were pretty
delicious.
Good. It was like.
My mouth is watering.
Yeah. It was pretty bacony tasting, and I don't know. I would do it again. No one else will. And I got tongues, too, in the freezer.
I'll try.
You'll try that?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay. Before we move on in this conversation, we're going to take a quick second to introduce a new segment called Mastering Glass with Sturka Optics, where we bring on Josh, product manager from Sturka, to answer a few quick questions about glassing. These are all questions that we get on our social media page, so if you have some, shoot us a message, and we'll make sure to get him answering those questions. How should someone set up a new pair of optics?
The first thing that you want to do is when you take them out of the box is of course, the first thing is to adjust the hinge. Make the hinge so that your pupils, the exit pupils, the little dots that you see if you hold the binocular away from your eyes, that those are lined up with your pupils themselves. First you want to adjust the hinge. And then after that, if you wear glasses, you want to leave your eye cups down. If you don't wear glasses, you want to put your eye cups up. And then after that, you would want to adjust the diopter. And I'm sure we'll get into that in another one.
And that was Mastering Glass with Sturka. Now back to our talk. Well,
I saved the tongues. That was something, I don't know what to do with them. That was something Cal always swore by. He used to steal all the tongues of everyone else's animals. But I don't know what to do with it.
No, same here. I got a couple deer tongues, and then we got a cow here.
I think it's a long process.
Yeah, you got to, like, blanch, I think. I could be totally wrong, but you got to get that outside right? stuff out, blanch it. Yeah, yeah. So you got your freezer full. Describe like what happened when you finally were able to connect with your moose.
It's emotional. It's like not emotional like you're crying, but I'm sure all of you have felt that when you've worked so hard over so many days for a specific animal or a specific tag, it's just a feeling of like utter relief and just utter gratitude too. I mean, because obviously I was really thankful that it was a quick kill. Because like part of that, I was definitely, I think the thing that kept me up at night was I chose to hunt with my 308. I only have one rifle and I used a heavier grain bullet, but I was definitely, I didn't know how many shots it was going to take.
Right.
And I think my biggest concern was that, you know, I'd wound it or that I would lose it or something would happen. And so there was definitely a sense of like relief seeing the animal on the ground. But yeah, it was like immediately, I took probably 2 minutes to sit there and take it in by myself. And then I texted everyone in my office and just said, moose down. And
That's
then my
awesome.
Phone started blowing up. And I think it took like 5 minutes before everyone in our town knew at that point.
I think Bridget had to come into the office that day. I don't remember. We had some sort of meeting or something you had to come in for. And it was like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what to compare it to, but she was definitely emotionally and mentally maybe not there because she was, drained was my take on it. Like, Bridget, I feel like you were just zapped.
I think all both of those things. Yeah. It's, you know, in the span of, cause I had gotten wind like late the night before about a group of moose fairly far south of where I live. And so I left, you know, super early before light and actually shot him around 9:30. So by the time I came in the office, I felt like I had been awake for like 48 hours and I'm so tired.
On all the physicality.
I luckily didn't have to pack it out very far. So I wasn't like literally dead tired, which was another thing that kind of kept me up at night. But it was just, it's just like after that many days, I've never hunted such a long season before. So I was pretty ready for it to be over.
That's awesome. Hey, coming from an Eastern whitetail hunter background, how do you feel like your transition to like the Western big game hunting went? Like, were you able to grasp it pretty quick or was there like a learning curve?
No. I think I'm extremely lucky working for First Light where I have so many people to help me with a faster learning curve. But last year was technically my first big game season and it was just a disaster. I mean, it was like a host of errors and like I hunted a lot, but it was like I didn't know what I was doing. And most of the times if I'd go out and solo hunt, I didn't even see an animal. I was doing like everything wrong.
Yep.
And I approached the season a little more methodically and I had a plan and I talked to a lot of people and accepted a lot of help. And I think that, and obviously I got very lucky by drawing two amazing tags, but
of course.
I think that helped me a lot this year.
You know, a lot of our listeners are from the east side of the country and we get a lot of questions about, you know, what would we recommend for going west? And, you know, there's a ton of things you could say. What would you recommend for someone, you know, say from Pennsylvania, going west for the first time?
For like an over-the-counter.
Over-the-counter, say like a Colorado or something where, you know, lots of tags, lots of animals.
Someone who's maybe doing this for the first time, doesn't maybe want to spend a ton of money on a, not a stay tag, but something that's kind of doable.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I spent a lot more time poring over maps than ever this year. And that is sort of priceless. I mean, actually knowing the terrain and not just like different drainages, but really getting to know the elevation helped me be a lot smarter about how I would go in and use my energy better. I think, you know, like when I was talking about my season, that was kind of a disaster the year prior. I would climb just like ridiculously steep slopes and then be like cashed, you know? And so I think definitely both Google Earth and Onyx, which I'm sure a lot of people are using back east as well, has become paramount. You know, I use that every day this season.
And
beyond
too.
That, I think apps will help too.
I think, and I'm not, but as experienced as Bridget is in terms of, obviously, I've grew up in the West, but having taken people hunting from that part of the country, I think one thing that people underestimate is often altitude.
Yeah,
and the amount of time it takes to, I mean, there are no shortcuts. And I think it's super important that people plan to acclimate themselves for like 2 to 3 days before they even start getting after it. Because I've seen over and over where people get after it on day 1 or 2 and that can cost them the enjoyment of the entire hunt. You break yourself. Your body can't repair. I mean, the cellular level, you can't come back from that. And, you know, no matter what you're hunting, you're just not going to have as much fun. So I always try and tell people, like, look, man, there's just no shortcut. You can't go from zero to 6,000 feet and or higher and skip that step.
Well, we're at 700 total feet here.
And I really feel like you're banging on our obesity rate over here.
Yeah, that's
right. No, I mean, to be fair, so we had some friends from another outdoor brand come out this year that we took mule deer hunting. They really wanted to, they're all whitetail hunters. They all really wanted to get their first mule deer. These are fit guys. I mean, not a lot of fat going on here. And then they are, you know, fitness fanatics, this, that, and the other. And they came out and, you know, to varying degrees, they learned exactly that it doesn't really matter. It's your body's ability to transport oxygen. Right. And, you just can't get around it. It doesn't matter what kind of shape you're in. I think to your point though, you know, trying to be in the best shape you literally can, you know, it's one thing to look at Western hunting pictures or magazines or, watching on TV. It's another thing to go up a ridge with a 30 pound pack on and gain 2000 feet. It's hard. So,
elevation will definitely change you.
So my family, will go out a couple, my wife, my daughter and I will go out a couple times during the year, to Colorado and stuff. And I remember the first time we went out to, I think we were at, trying to forget where, were we by Maroon Bells? And we go out. My wife was kind of not feeling great. And she gets out. She takes one step and immediately pukes in the bushes. And was, altitude sickness, terrible. But thankfully, we were staying with a family who had an oxygen tank.
I like how Bridget
tank.
Just laughed at that.
I know. Thank you. Yeah. They had an oxygen tank guy that was had leukemia at one point and needed an oxygen tank. And so they hooked her up and it immediately fixed it. Yeah, it was incredible. It's just lack of oxygen in your blood, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So I would imagine, you know, Bridget, you mentioned before kind of showing up to a meeting a little bit exhausted and tired from a hunt like this. Do you get a little bit more leeway because you work for a hunting brand, or are they pretty strict with you over there?
I would say we're treated very well. Both.
That's a good answer.
Ross is listening.
He's definitely listening.
Part of the lifestyle. It truly is like part of the lifestyle of living here in the mountains. There's, you know, everyone in our office hunts and hunts hard. And beyond that, there's, you know, like we're in the middle of winter. We finally got some serious snow in the last 2 days. And we have kind of jokingly what we call the 6-inch powder rule, where like the owners don't want to see you in the office before, you know, 9:30 that morning. If you're here, you should be on the mountain. And so I would say, yeah, we definitely have some serious leeway when it comes to hunting. And we want to make sure everybody's getting time in the field and that they can authentically speak about the gear we sell. If, you know, somebody calls our guys in customer service, they better be knowledgeable about it and be putting serious days in.
Well, and you guys mentioned, you know, switching sales models to, you know, direct consumer. So I'd imagine things like experiences and being able to talk about a product is pretty huge to sell stuff, especially with social media.
For sure. Yes. Yeah. So we have a good variety of, you know, it's become important to us as we expanded our collection. I think Ross was planning to talk about it a little bit, but we've really gotten, you know, a much more expanded collection in our whitetail line. And we were actually just realizing as we took a step back and looked at our company, we have potentially more whitetail hunters and guys both from the Midwest and the East than we do like the guys from the Rocky Mountains at this point. And it's cool that they can talk about it and that they put in time and that they're going back East, you know, multiple times a year to make sure they're maintaining those skills and that they can authentically talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you guys make, and we use a bunch of your stuff, incredible stuff for Whitetown West. One of my favorite things are the fingerless merino gloves. It's like a small item, I know, but I literally, no matter how cold or warm it is, have those.
Underneath some sort of glove.
Me too. Sometimes I'm even just wearing those at my desk. Those are the best.
Yeah. You make it sound like we don't heat the office.
Right. If you start putting on those lobster gloves, you know, that I see you guys, then you should probably turn the heat up. That's right.
I think that's, but to Bridget's point, I think to circle back to your earlier question, I think it's like important to note that a lot of the Midwestern guys in our office and East Coast guys became proficient elk hunters or mule deer hunters like pretty damn quickly. And I think what a lot of people on the East, and this is like pretty important to us that people know this, like, man, if you're a good whitetail hunter, if you're proficient at it, if you understand how to hunt the wind and all that sort of stuff, it's really not like any sort of voodoo out here. I mean, the guys that came out here that were real whitetail killers that worked for us and moved to Idaho, they're killing elk their first year. They're like, it's not, the principles are all the same. As long as you've got legs underneath you and you've got that desire to get it done. I mean, I always tell people on the East Coast or Midwest, like, get out here. It's not any different than what you're already doing.
How do you go from, you know, I would imagine you're talking about these experiences people have, and I would imagine that goes into huge, plays in huge for how you design gear. How does it, you know, walk us through from idea or maybe a need that you see to final product? How does that look for you guys?
Probably the most unique thing about First Light, and as we've grown, you know, so when I started there, Cal was on board, and I was employee number two. So just four guys in an office. We quickly hired Casey, so there's five. Mm-hmm. We're a lot bigger now, and so this kind of thing becomes a little bit more difficult, but we really do literally include everybody in the product development process. Now, obviously, we have a product development director and leadership in that area, but when we're developing a given product, if it's a whitetail product, you know, we're obviously, we have all those guys from the Midwest in the room from stage one, where we kind of conceptually draw out what we need, to the final stages where we're literally doing fit tests and, you know, wear tests and all that. And then we send them out in the field, right, with it. And so as an example, you may have seen the podcast that Mark Kenyon did, you know, mm-hmm. one of our guys, one of our product guys went out hunting with Mark and brought a bunch of the next year's stuff for him to use. We beg those guys to try and break it. We beg them to tell us what they hate about it, right? Yeah. So we try and put all our stuff through at least one season before it sees the light of day. And sometimes that can be two seasons if we feel like it's not really up to our spec. But I guess most importantly, it really is a collaborative effort at First Light, where, you know, everybody from the customer service guys to the owners are involved at some point during product development. And that's, I think, what makes us a little bit more successful, is simply the amount of different eyeballs and brains involved in that process.
Then you're really getting a big collaborative effort from everybody. Everyone's maybe got a little bit idea of how to fix something here, change something a little there. So that's awesome. You guys are really doing it good. You're building some quality products.
Well, and you never know. I mean, it speaks to a couple things. I mean, one, to your point, like, so I've worked for, and as of Bridget, we both worked for larger outdoor companies, right? I worked for Smith Optics. And so someone at Smith in customer service would never, ever, ever, they'd rarely walk upstairs to where product was, let alone,
sure,
you know, be at all involved in the development. And that's nothing against Smith. It was just the size and the way it worked. And at First Light, I mean, our customer service guys could have an idea, and they often do, because of where they come from, like, hey, let's put that zipper and make it run the other way, because when I'm actually in the stand, this happens or whatever. And you just get sort of paradigms that you would never, ever see otherwise. And then the other part of it that I think is really important is that the employees are all involved in it, right? So when they're talking to customers, they know the story of how that product was developed. They've worn it. They were involved in its inception. So they believe in it, right? And you're not just handing your guys on the phone some product and saying, hey, when someone calls about them, tell them about this.
Right.
It's well past that. They know the product. They've been using it for at least a season, and they were probably involved in some iota of developing it.
Right. You're building that connection around the product.
Yeah.
Totally.
Do you ever get like down the road, like really far down the road, and just realize this is not going to work and have to scrap the whole idea? Or is it usually
absolutely.
Like, really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean,
are you able to give an example of something?
Yeah, I can. Okay. I got to be careful of what kind of specifics I go into, but we were to what we call final article stage product development talk for, okay, this is it, go out and use it, but it's too late to change it, right? And this was a year and a half into this particular piece. It was a jacket in the whitetail world. And we got to that stage, put it out into field testing, and
we just were not at all happy with how it performed. It honestly was just subpar for what we felt like the first light product experience should be. So we literally slammed the brakes on, went through an absolute fire drill of replacing the entire fabric that we were using on it. And we were able to pull it off, or we still got to spend quite a bit of time in the revised version. And you have to understand, not to get too granular, but when you change fabric on a outerwear piece, that's like you're about to ship your trucks to the dealership and you're swapping the motor out right before. I mean, it's insane the amount of variables that come with simply, hey, let's use a different fabric. So, and that sort of thing has happened several times on various projects. We've had projects that we've just straight up killed because we couldn't reach what we wanted to conceptually. We said, you know, if we wanted an ultra quiet and waterproof product X, and a year and a half later, we were still 2 miles away, and we just said, maybe this isn't going to happen. Right. You know, it's not reaching what we want our customers to experience.
Well, and speaking of fabric, I mean, you guys kind of revolutionized things in the, at least in the hunting industry by, you know, having camo merino. Tell us a little bit about that decision to enter the market with something merino when really no one else had been doing that.
Yeah. So, that's kind of how the company got started. That was before any of us were on board. It was just the two founders, Scott and Kenton. And a long story short, both of them are, you know, extraordinary athletes and winter sport athletes. So Kenton, I believe, was a pro or semi-pro snowboarder for a while. Scott was, you know, Division I ski racer, and they do a lot of ski mountaineering, snowboard mountaineering. And so they started using merino while they did that. We actually had a company called Icebreaker relocate their headquarters to little old Ketchum, Idaho. And everybody in Ketchum starts wearing Icebreaker's merino. Well, Scott and Kenton start wearing it, and they're like, man, we go on these massive winter trips, spend days in the same base layers, take it off, and there's no odor. Yeah. And there's no shine to it. It's kind of this miracle fabric, and they're scratching their heads wondering why nobody's using it in hunting. What they figured out quite quickly was that nobody had figured out or engineered how to print camouflage on 100%, let's call it top grade merino wool. It couldn't be done at that point.
Like, so we didn't have the technology for it, or we just
didn't have exactly. Well, let's say there wasn't a process in place, a manufacturing process, right? So they couldn't. Nobody at that point had said to a, you know, wool manufacturer, hey, we need this printed on there and it needs to look exactly perfect. Now, you could do different colors and you could do some really basic stuff, but to make crisp lines and anything that was suitable for high-end camouflage was not happening. So that's kind of how Scott and Kenton came together, and they were already close friends. They're like, man, this is a huge opportunity. This is a miracle fabric. We apply this to hunting where you have a natural fabric that literally cannot hold bacteria. I mean, that's the kind of voodoo behind merino, is that at a cellular level, if you look at the little fibers on merino, bacteria cannot adhere to it. So bacteria is what you smell. And that was kind of the driver. They're like, okay, well, let's see what it takes. And it took a lot of time, a lot of money. And next thing you know, they came out with our, you know, very first line some 10 years ago of printed camouflage, 100%, you know, grade A merino base layers. And that's how the company was founded.
What was it like, you know, because a lot of times bringing a new product to market, you have to convince the consumer that it's, you know, a worthwhile thing. What was that, you know, was that an uphill battle, or was it pretty easy to convince people that this is, you know, this is worthwhile?
You know, at that point, it was largely Kenton doing his thing. And Kenton, frankly, is like one of those preternatural people person. He can, you meet him and you're like best buddies with him in 15 seconds flat.
Right.
And it's not a salesy, cheesy thing. He's just a very genuine person. He's really funny. And he's also extraordinarily nerdy when it comes to product. So I think his ability to convince people to just try things was probably what got it off the ground. And he, you know, at that point, identified a lot of influencers, a lot of really key account owners, shop owners throughout the industry, and basically gave them all boxers. And was like, hey, go try this stuff. And if you like it, you know, we're trying to get off the ground. And these guys would kind of shake their heads, take the product, and then phone would be ringing. So it very, very much was a very grassroots built company. Scott was still working at Smith with me while they were founding this company. So, you know, and Kenton was doing full-time photography, which was his profession at the time. So it very much was like a born in a garage, shoestring budget idea that blossomed into this, you know, good just sized like brand that it is today.
You know, I can believe though, Merino Undies have, you know, they've changed my whole perception of the world. My worldview is different after wearing, you know, Merino's undies.
Yep. That will happen.
Yeah.
We had a, an account, a really, really, really good account, the Bow Rack in Springfield, Oregon, a fantastic archery shop. And as the story goes, the lore is that Wayne, who is one of the owners, he and his wife own it, as First Light was getting going and he would have his regular customers would come in, he would give his customers a pair of the boxers, to your point. Really? And he would say, hey, these are $50 boxers, take them. And if you like them, come back and buy some more of the kit. And, okay. You know, at that point, this was a couple of years ago, but Wayne used to say he was batting 100. I mean, people would try those boxers and be like, yeah. It was like a religious experience.
They stay on well. They don't ever smell. You can bring like less stuff when you're going way back. Yep. And it's awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's been cool. And then developing outerwear that meets that same caliber has also been very, very rewarding. So creating this whole system all the way out to, you know, the Whitetail system and all the other lines that we offer has been a lot of fun and involved a lot of people.
What's your favorite piece of gear that you've, that First Light has come out with so far?
Oh, wow. That is, it depends on the year. There are products that I still use. I mean, the Obsidian Pant, I think, which used to be known as the Knab 2. Yeah, prior to that, it was the Knab. Prior to that, there was a version that was very ill-fitting. It was like Justin Bieber, like super tight in your cash and prizes, not comfortable. that was like 12 years ago. But that basically the Merino wool pants are,
you wear those,
you know, unbelievably game changing. Around here, we will, doesn't matter what season it is. You might be archery elk hunting, antelope hunting, or it can be rifle elk in November. Yep. And you've got one pair of pants that can operate from literally, you know, 100 degrees and up all the way down to single digits. And that's pretty mind blowing.
I mean, I have the set of the 2.0s in ASAT camo, and they're,
yep,
like you're saying, you can, it's so utilizable. You can use it anywhere.
Yeah, I don't think utilizable
is it a word? No, I've been making up words lately.
I think now though, like, I mean, you got my wheels turning. I think my favorite product right now today is our Catalyst system that came out, was introduced this last year in 2018. Ben, our product guy, managed to develop a fabric that kind of did what we've always been told was impossible. And that is, I mean, it's literally silent, but it's totally breathable. It's windproof. And actually, technically, it's on the waterproof scale. And so it's a soft shell jacket and a soft shell pant that is, you know, Bridget and I are always scratching our heads talking about how we can get people to understand that it is equally applicable to elk hunters as it is to stand hunters, because it's dead silent. You know, even from the outdoor industry, right? Like mountaineering and all that sort of stuff. And that's kind of where we play a lot. And what we, the benchmark we hold our product to, the Catalyst, is game changing in all categories. It's really amazing.
Oh yeah. I'm going to ask
this
Bridget.
This is so hard.
Yeah,
I was going to say, this just makes me want to tell you guys about new stuff, but we're not launching 2019 just yet. But there's like some amazing stuff coming down the pipeline for women that I've gotten the advanced opportunity to wear, and that will just, it's a game changer for the women's line.
You could tell us a little bit more about it. We wouldn't hate you for it.
Let's just say that was a good transition into the women's conversation.
Absolutely.
But there is some super cool things coming down, and I feel like, you know, obviously being one of the only females at the company, I'm going to sound a little bit biased, but I feel like I can genuinely say that I can be unbiased about First Light women's gear being the best on the market, because Ross actually pulled me away. I was a hunting apparel buyer. And so I have wear tested everything out there. And, you know, I got to try some of the new women's base layer when it was new at the time. And I was wearing that, you know, I'd worn Icebreaker, I'd worn Under Armour, I'd worn Sitka and everything else out there. And I can say I've, at least at one point, I was unbiased about this. And so from my standpoint, just the fact that I can dress myself from head to toe in gear that was made for a female hunter and somebody who's going to be, you know, putting in those days and weeks and Jesus, like months sometimes, it really does make a difference to have stuff that's built to last. And it's just as technical as the men's gear.
Oh yeah.
So it's definitely hard to pick favorites.
My wife wears, I think it's the Artemis hoodie, I think is what it is. And she loves it. She wears that all the time.
That's what definitely, you know, it's the new fabric. We're calling it the Kiln hoodie now. It is maybe the most like all purpose piece. I almost always have that on, like no matter what time of year it is. So that just goes back to that merino conversation that it's so versatile for any type of hunt and any type of weather. It's definitely like if you're going to get one thing, that's what I tell women to start with because you're going to use it for everything.
Now, are you guys, do you guys get snotty about your, what you're wearing? Like, will you only let merino touch your skin, you know, at any point of the day? Or is this, do you wear other clothes as well when you're out and about?
That's a funny question because I actually had a good friend of mine, been friends with forever, who is a hardcore big game hunter out here. And he recently, it was a text, he was asking, he'd been in First Light for so long, he's like, what other alternatives should I look at? And I realized, I'm like, man, I haven't really worn anything hunting besides merino for the past 6 years or something.
Right.
And, you know, before that, it was Capeline, it was everything, you know, everything you get your hands on. And once you try merino, I mean, we hear it 1,000 times a day. It's just, it's really hard to go back. Yeah, I think there are some very compelling synthetic base layers out there, but nothing that can do what merino can do for the hunter.
Yeah.
Explicitly.
You know, I took my dad out elk hunting last year and he had some synthetics base layers. And like within half an hour, it seemed maybe more. He's a big guy, but he stunk. You know, that, I mean, he was producing a funk.
He was very right.
And I didn't change the entire week. I had merino on. It was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, there's the odor is the aha moment for most of our customers, right? They buy it, they go on some sort of multi-day anything, and they wear their underwear for multi-days. And, you know, they'll come up to us at a consumer show and be like, dude, you'll never believe this. I wore my underwear for 5 days, and it didn't stink. And it's, you know.
You're not and alone.
Yeah, we hear that a lot. We actually used to have a rep that would have a set of First Light boxers, and he would go to training sessions with our box stores, and he'd have employees come up and he'd be like, yeah, so merino, you know, it's silent. It's totally insulating when you're soaking wet, and it doesn't smell like these things, and merino doesn't smell at all. And they'd smell them. And then he would tell them that he had worn them for the last 4 days. After these people had passed around a pair of boxers and sniffed them.
Yeah.
And this gentleman, God bless him, is not someone like, it's just the whole picture was quite overwhelming, but it was also incredibly effective. I mean, these people would just be like, wow, you know, and he wasn't lying. He had been wearing them.
Yeah. You know, and I've tried like the synthetics. I've tried bamboo. Yep. Bamboo fell apart like on me and it didn't work very well.
Especially, I mean, even for Eastern hunting, you know, merino is equally as effective. And I think that's something that we've enjoyed kind of watching our whitetail customer learn, you know, whereas Western people may have used merino hiking or skiing or something to that effect. But learning how effective it is in the tree stand is pretty fun.
Speaking of a tree stand, Ross, you haven't told us about your season. It sounded like you didn't have so much excitement as Bridget, but do you have anything good happening?
Yeah, I mean, if Bridget hadn't drawn my moose tag, then I probably would have had a...
You were probably next in line,
yeah, right?
Totally. I mean, there's no question. As a matter of fact, in that video, you can kind of like see my brain process. Bridget just drew this. That means there's no chance. There's only 3 of those tags. So
the one guy in the room crying while everyone else is
Yeah, saying. Like I just... Inside, I was weeping and curled up in the fetal position. But... No, my hunting season actually was interesting. It was a lot of fun. I ended up just simply, like a lot of people do in our industry, I ended up tagging along on a lot of hunts, taking a lot of people hunting, and not spending maybe as much time hunting myself. I also have a new gun dog that I committed myself. That's actually why I put in for the moose tag. I was like, okay, I won't draw this, and then I won't feel obligated to big game hunt the whole time, and I'll be able to hunt this puppy as much as possible.
Yeah.
But what I guess the takeaway, what I really learned was how much fun it is to tag along and help someone experience their first, you know, in this case, mule deer hunts or elk hunts, whatever. It's equally, if not more rewarding than doing it yourself. And that's kind of, that was largely how my season went, was just having people from out of town in quite a bit. And,
well, and you even hunted with me, like a couple post-work hunts we went out on, and you ended up finding like some good mule deer spots out of it. I had seen a moose in a general area, and Ross came out with me to help scout, and we kind of turned it into a mule deer hunt a couple times.
Yeah,
which was
true. Definitely learned some new areas, and you know, I had a lot of fun. We took that group from New Hampshire out, from our friends in the outdoor world, and we took them into an area that I had not hunted a whole lot, which was pretty magical. And then of course, you know, when you're out in Idaho and spending any amount of time out there, you're going to see things that, you know, whether it's wolves or whatever, moose, all kinds of animals and all kinds of critters. And you just, you know, does it really matter if you're pulling the trigger or not? I would argue that it probably doesn't.
It's an adventure every time you're out there. Something cool you see, you know. Go ahead.
Ross, I was just going to make sure you tell them about your llamas.
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of de facto llama guy. Every year I do a backcountry trip with pack llamas. Yeah, a friend of mine, this gentleman by the name of Bo Beatty, really good guy. Mm-hmm. Long story, but he started a business where he rents out pack llamas to people that they can take in. And it's very similar to if you have horses or mules, only you don't get to ride them and they're, you know, half the pain in the ass that mules or horses are. But what it involves, I mean, you get to go 10 miles into the backcountry, you get to carry, you know, you're not carrying like your lazy boy in there, but you know, we always have a bottle of Jameson, which is probably something I would not be packing in on my back. You know what I mean? So there's little creature comforts that make camp a little bit more comfortable, and the llamas are a lot of fun. And if you get lucky and you get to harvest an animal, the llamas are a godsend, packing out an elk or something like that. So yeah, we took the llamas out this year and had a really good time and got to see some good stuff and watch some good people harvest mule deer.
Well, it's handy to have something like that, you know, carrying a bunch of like luxury gear out. Mm. I normally just see Jared throw his bourbon in his Camelback. And so that's what keeps him going in the mountains.
I like
There's no shame in that.
You don't get very far. He falls asleep pretty fast, but
yeah. Yeah, no, it's really nice. I mean, it's just small things. You might get to bring a, you know, heavier four season tent instead of a ultralight one. You get to bring a heavier sleeping bag, just little things that make you comfortable, and then try and leave enough weight capacity to pack an animal out. And if and when you do, you're kind of laughing, because instead of the 10-mile like repeated death march of total pain, you're actually kind of smiling and laughing as this animal is carrying all your horns and meat out. It's great.
Yeah. Do they have names?
They do. Bo named them all, and this is the crazy part. So wrap your head around this. This guy's got 175 llamas, and they all have names, and he can look at them from across the pasture and tell you what who's who and what's what and their entire lineage, the whole nine.
I don't even know that many people.
That's what I said.
I can't even remember that many names. I don't even know that many. Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and they all have personalities. I mean, Bo's llamas are all extraordinarily well-trained. This sounds crazy, but, you know, the uninitiated get very comfortable with them very quickly because they are very well-mannered. They can cross rivers. Cool thing about llamas, they have, you know, soft feet, so they can go anywhere literally you can. I mean, I've down timber, shale, side hilling, really steep, rocky stuff. They don't care. They just motor along right behind you in their string, and, you know, they're very, very versatile.
So you take them out. Do you leave them back at camp? Like, you know, you set up somewhere and then you just tie them up and nothing bothers them, or nothing happens to them?
Yeah, so you get to camp. Typically what we do is we'll set up camp, and then we stake the llamas down so that they have about 10 yards in circumference that they can graze. Really cool thing about llamas is you don't have to pack hay. They're natural foragers.
They'll just eat grass the whole time. Yep.
Yeah. And then the wild part about it is they're camelids. So they voluntarily drink maybe once every 3 to 4 days.
Wow.
So you take a lot of the needs of traditional pack animals out of the equation. And yeah, you take them up there, you stake them out, and then we'll hunt that area maybe for a day or two. You know, we typically move the llamas once a day so they have fresh
yep.
immediate area of grass, and then we'll, you know, offer them water. A lot of times they don't want it. And you hunt that area, and then you pack them up, and you move, you know, maybe a couple miles up the trail or up the mountain or whatever, and you repeat. So it makes the whole sort of junk show of backcountry hunting into a pretty efficient and definitely, like, calorically efficient machine, because you get in there at 8 or 9 miles, and you're not carrying a pack.
Right.
You're not carrying anything, and you're fresh. You're ready to hunt instead of, like, getting to camp and passing out with, you know, half your tent up and, you know, whatever.
Setting a tent up after you hike in with a heavy pack by yourself, it's the worst. I think of all the parts of the hunt, like setting it up when you're really tired, you finally get there, it's like half dark usually. And I hate that part. Kick. Yeah. You're tired.
Yeah. Nobody likes that. And then you make dinner.
Yep.
And then you get all your stuff together for the next morning, and you know you have to be up at, you know, 5 or, you know, whatever 0 dark 30 hour it's going to be. And it's very daunting. And if, especially in our situation, where we're often taking people hunting, whether it's, you know, partners of ours or whomever, having the llamas and taking that equation off our guests is really nice. Plus, they love the llamas. I mean, llamas have a lot of personality and a lot of character, and they're pretty funny, goofy animals.
Do they have ever, are there any, ever any issues with, like, mountain lions or wolves or any bears or anything out there with those things, leaving them unattended all day?
You know, yes and no. So I know Bo told me, and this was as of at least a year or two ago, he's only had one run in. He had a client that had a llama, and when the client came back to camp, there was a mountain lion literally, I guess, feeding on one of his llamas that was still alive. The hunter was able to kill the lion, and the llama lived.
What?
He still has him. Yeah.
I want a llama. Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is, for whatever reason, supposedly, you know, a lot of predators, particularly canine predators, are scared of llamas. The hypothesis being that they have these, you know, their ears stand erect, right? And they look like sharp horns. And I don't know if that really makes sense, because why aren't they afraid of elk? Maybe because they've learned to eat them so much. But,
right.
You know, people do employ llamas as guardian llamas for livestock flocks, right? And so there's got to be some truth to it. Yeah.
So wait, a guardian, so they, like, put them out with sheep or something like that, and they keep predators away?
Yeah, that was my introduction to llamas, actually. Is I used to own a bunch of sheep, and I'd sell lamb on the side. Is when I worked at Smith, I decided I was going to be like a part-time rancher, which is a, you know, expletive deleted disaster. There's no such thing as a part-time rancher. And if you think you're going to be a rancher, all you're really doing is fixing fencing the whole time. But right. Yeah, I got a llama. This is an awful story. I was losing lambs to coyotes, as is the case in Idaho quite a bit. And yep. I was at the feed store, and I'm talking to the lady there, and I'm like, you know, I keep losing lambs. I'm trying to shoot these things, but, you know, they sneak in, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, you need a llama. You put one single llama in with a herd of sheep, and it thinks it's part of that herd. It becomes sort of matronly or whatever in a protective manner, and it will charge predators.
Wow.
And I'm like, and so in my head, I'm like, maybe I should consider this. And the lady literally says, hold on a second. She picks up the phone. She's like, oh, hey, Ed, it's, you know, so-and-so. I got a guy here who needs a llama. Are you still trying to get rid of yours? And I'm like, hold on, like, pump the brakes, lady. I don't know if I'm ready for this. And she's like, you'll be down here in like 2 minutes. This guy shows up with a stock trailer on his truck with two llamas. And he's like, I'll give you your pick between the two. And I was like, well, hold on here. Like, how much money are we talking? And he's like, how about a case of Keystone Light?
Wow.
Done and deal. Done.
Deal.
Oh, yeah. Me being young and poor and
that
losing.
That's the flag.
Totally. I mean, like, that's like a massive red flag. Anything that involves a case of Keystone Light for livestock, like, clearly the guy was like, I will give you both these llamas and you don't have to give me anything. But then he smelled Keystone Light in the water and was able to get that.
Brilliant on his part. Yeah.
Sharks.
So I took a llama home. She looked eerily like Janet Reno. So that's what we called her. It was Janet Reno. And
that is great.
She guarded our sheep for a little while until, I don't know, a couple of years later, I was out there. I don't remember what I was doing. I was driving into the pasture, and I saw a coyote with a lamb in its mouth run right by Janet. And Janet just looks at it and is like, hey, what's up? And then she just goes back to grazing. So Janet got fired and she's now like living in Western Washington somewhere or something. But
poor Janet.
Greener pastures. Yep.
Greener, yeah, she's having a good time. But that's that was my introduction to llamas. And then when I read about pack llamas, I was like, that makes sense. That could be something that they're actually like well suited for.
Right. That would be fun. And it's just extra fun. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we're coming up on time. And I appreciate so much for you guys just to hop on and talk to us a little bit, share some stories, yep, and tell us about your year. So thank you so much. Do you have any final thoughts or any conclusions you want to talk about, Jared?
No.
Well, thanks for having us. It'd be great to meet up at some point. Hopefully we cross paths in person here soon.
Oh, absolutely. We make our way out there quite a bit.
And so. We like Keystones.
Yeah, that's right. So now that we know Keystones are in play.
I also, my final thought would be to revisit what we talked about earlier. If you live out east and you're like at all intimidated by coming Western hunting and doing the DIY thing, don't be. Like, just try it. You've already got the skill set. Tags are not that much money. Find an archery tag that's in either sex so that you can kill a cow elk if you have the opportunity. But give it a shot. I mean, you're going to have a great time, worst case scenario. Best case, you get some meat. But, I just don't think it should be as daunting as we often hear people think it is.
Yeah. I hear about that a lot. Yeah. A lot of times, a lot of my friends have gone out and they put so much pressure on themselves. You know, it's expensive to go out. You drive or you fly. There's all this, planning you have to do. And it seems like all the pressure that they put on themselves kind of ruin it a little bit. I would add to what you said and just like have fun, like we were saying before. I mean, it's all about just having a good time. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, I mean, no matter what, you're going to have some kind of crazy experience out there just because you're putting yourself in a, more of a fantastic environment than, maybe normal.
And even just stepping outside your comfort zone for a week.
There's so much fun. Yeah, it'll change your...
That's it, right? Yep. Yep. I mean, you just nailed it. That's what it's about, is getting outside your comfort zone. And it's just not as daunting as I think, unfortunately, sometimes the hunting media or our friends and social media and all that sort of thing make it look. It can be as daunting or as friendly as you want it to be, but you're going to get outside of your comfort zone, you're going to do something different, and you're going to experience something, probably life-changing. So don't be afraid. Get after it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much. And I really appreciate it. We'll probably talk to you real soon.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you guys. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
All right. Ending recording. All right. Well, thank you guys. That was fun. Really appreciate taking the time. It's really fun to talk and learn, and it's the most fun about a podcast is just like
hearing stories that everyone has
stories and just, everybody's got a different point of view. So really appreciate you doing that.
Likewise. And we appreciate the opportunity, and it's always fun to talk to different audiences and get some feedback from that side of things too. So we look forward to you guys posting it and seeing what happens.
Cool. Yeah. We'll let you know when we do. Tom, you have Bridget's email. Yep. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Yep.
See ya.
Bye. All right, guys. Joe, are you on?